G'day and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour and I'm joined by John. How are you, John?
I'm doing quite well.
And Mark Christensen can't be with us this week because he is busily working actually on something for me. So I hold him no ill will on that score. And I think David's actually shooting today. So this week we're going to be looking at what was just awarded the Emmy for Best Special Effects in a Miniseries. And this is John Adams. John Adams, an HBO special that miniseries that was put together. And the principal visual effects houses on it were Cafe Effects and some other really good work done by Digital Backlot and people. But as we like to do, let's start off by discussing actually the show itself, or rather the miniseries. And John, what did you think?
Well, I had the opportunity to see this because literally everyone around me was recommending it. I'm not a really big fan of historical work like this. In fact, I usually don't care much for this type of fare. I wasn't a big fan of Master and Commander or anything like that. But this really reminded me, there's a book that I read a while ago by Caleb Carr called The Alienist, and it remains one of my top 10 favorite novels. It's historical fiction, but it remains one of my top 10 books of all time. And this really had that kind of resonance with me. I thought it was just miraculous in how good it was, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, now I've got to ask you a question. I'm an Australian. We didn't study American history, of course. I had no idea who John Adams was. I certainly didn't know that his son went on to become president. Just how well known is the life and times of John Adams? I mean, I guess the times are well known, but how well do you think generally he was known in America?
Well, it's a difficult question to answer because my experience so far is that most people are not familiar with our history. Most Americans are not really that familiar with our history at all. We take a few history classes in school, and in college there's a little bit of it, but really unless you seek it out, you don't get an opportunity to really even remotely understand the time period or the people involved. And I would wager that a majority of Americans could not tell you that John Adams was our second president.
Well, now, he falls into that category, and I mean, I've used this many times, you know, who was the second U.S. president? Who was the second man on the moon? Who was the second guy to climb Everest? Like, the second guy doesn't ever tend to be as prominent as the first guy. But having said that, the people around him, not just Washington, but Franklin and Roosevelt and people were, you know, pretty much immortalized into a sort of a subculture of heroic historical figures. And yet he seemed to have sort of slipped through. But watching the miniseries and having researched it a bit purely for my own benefit through the incredibly in-depth world of Wikipedia and Google and stuff, it did seem like
right. The
miniseries was very accurate to what is understood to be his life. Is that how you understand it?
Yeah, I think so. It's funny. A while ago, I had been recommended the book John Adams by David McCullough, on which this miniseries is based, and I'd been recommended that book by several of my friends who, study history and are in fact some of which are practicing historians. A few of which consult the Hollywood, and so they'd recommended the book based on the historical accuracy of it. So I think they had a really rich foundation. I know David McCullough has done a tremendous amount of work in researching the period and all of the events. And I know that the letters between John and his wife Abigail are fairly widely available now. And there's so many letters between the two of them. It is really kind of interesting.
Unfortunately for them, but fortunately for us, they lived apart for so much of their lives due to his role as an ambassador into Europe. And so I guess had they been so close together, of course we would not have had the need for them to write the letters and had that snapshot on their lives. So let's discuss authenticity for a second, because I thought the film reeked of visual authenticity. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. It's really interesting. I did a ridiculous amount of preparation for this show, and I have to confess that all of that preparation is basically going to put me in a position where I'm going to mix up everything, because there's so much information in just who did what and how much research was done and who is connected to the back set, the sets that were created and the set design and the visual effects. And there's a such a rich melding of visual effects with set design, with all of these other things, that I'm just going to completely screw up everyone. So I just want to apologize for that in advance. But the things that I've seen have both been historically accurate where appropriate, and there are places where they kind of took a little bit of liberty to make it not historically accurate, but aesthetically accurate, and accurate in a way that would tell a better story. So there's a few little bit of, you know, cheats on the history of it, but I think for the most part it is. I know the costumes at the time, there was a discussion from one of the persons who was doing the work, the costume work, and they were talking about how a lot of people believe that at the time the period, you know, in which this is set, 1770 to I guess nearly 40 years later, a lot of people thought that the costumes were very heavy, but in fact there was a lot of silk and a lot of really light cloth, and just layer upon layer of that. So I know that is very accurate.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think there were some really interesting things that happened, you know, in all aspects. And just before you get to visual effects, I mean, in terms of costume and stuff, well, a costume designer was talking, I think, on the DVD extras. I mean, I got sent a lot of stuff because this was actually the category I was nominated for an Emmy in, so I get tons of stuff sent to vote for this. And in that, there was a discussion about how the costume designer actually had John Adams or Paul's costume sort of, for example, slightly tight and ill-fitting when he was in Europe, because this would make him uncomfortable, and this would kind of be the subtext of his, you know, discomfort at being at these foreign, you know, very lavish kind of courts and environments. And then the way that the teeth were aged, if you note in the thing, George Washington in the show comments on how bad his teeth are. And by the end of the series, the two hero actors or actresses have got shocking teeth. And this sort of progression of keeping people dirty and muddy and, you know, actually building the correct sort of farming environment at their farm, and making sure that all of the ways that farm was sort of built was accurate to the period. And I do love a program that has visual authenticity to it. I think it adds enormously. I think you're right. Obviously, it's a drama, not a documentary. So there were places where they kind of not bent the truth, but obviously tried to, you know, dramatize and perhaps concatenate events to make things slightly more more suitable for an audience. And yet, I do feel it held true enough to the original material that I don't have the criticism that I've often made of things like, say, Amadeus the film. People have heard of me criticize it before, because in that they actually shot under candlelight at some points. They actually did no lights. They just used candles, because this is what they would have had in the day, and this is how it would have looked. And they had like, you know, hundreds or thousands of candles lit and for a particular shot. And so you know, as the audience, you were soaking up this visual authenticity, going, wow, this must have been exactly what it was like. Only to discover that the story was written by a playwright in New York. It wasn't that researched. There were major characters right in his life that were never even mentioned. But the filmmakers had gone so far with the visual authenticity that, you know, now that film has helped rewrite history in terms of the general, you know, zeitgeist of what it was back then and how it worked, and certainly his life. And I think that's the danger, as well as the benefit, of visual effects doing tremendously good work, is that if you make it look so real, so believable, and the plot is completely off, then you actually, you know, because a lot of people, and let's not beat around the bush here, for a lot of people, they're watching this and they have a really great understanding of history. And yet there are another good, substantial bunch of people that, as you say, probably didn't have the history background, who are just going to, you know, casually watch the show and then just assume that the events are the way they were depicted in the film. And that, you know, maybe it's a slight on our Western culture, but it's the truth. And so I think if visual effects and everybody else is doing such a great job to get it right, it'd be nice if the story kind of hung true. And certainly from my reading, it did. So let's discuss some of the visual effects. And I guess there's 7 parts to the miniseries, so we're going to have to jump around a bit.
Right.
But were there any particular sequences or areas of the visual effects that you thought worked particularly well?
Oh my God, where do I start? So much of it was so good. I mean, I could start, so from a sort of holistic perspective, I want to start with the overarching look, which is something you touched on earlier. the characters were grimy and sweaty and dirty and it just you just got a you know, you could sense the odor coming off of them because they were just filthy a lot of times. And the thing that I noticed, the thing that I actually noticed first when I was watching the first part of it, is that the film itself is a dark and murky and gloomy, desaturated look just overall. I mean, just the color of the, when I say film, the color of the miniseries is just grungy, and you really get that sense. And I was there was something when, you know, in the very opening scene when Paul Giamatti's riding the horse and he's coming across the snow, and there was something that felt really bizarre about it to me. I just thought, this is dark and there's something odd about this scene. And then I actually did a tremendous amount of research to figure out that it turns out that the that opening scene was in fact shot where he was riding his horse in front of a forest. And the entire background, that huge, vast, you know, dark landscape that is shown, is a replacement.
It is a remarkable sequence, and it sets the tone so well, as you say, because it has that kind of eerie, forebodingness that comes through so well, serving the plot. And you're right; I mean, an astonishing amount of set replacement, and not only that, but for a bunch of different varieties. I mean, you're talking there at the first, I think, first shot of the first scene where...
Yeah, literally the first 1 minute of the series.
But had I not known, I would have assumed most of this story was going to take place in America. And of course, we have Amsterdam, Paris, London, and then the Atlantic crossing, which was all shot on top of a grassy knoll, on top of a hill.
Right.
And so they've obviously had to do, as you'd expect, a huge amount of work to build out those locations. But... they had a very large practical set that they built in the middle of a field. Of course, they only built that two stories high, so the rest of the buildings had to be digitally extended. So I think the shot count from Cafe FX is around 320 shots. Oh, no, so I think it might be 320 in total, and they did check that. But, yeah, so there was a lot of that kind of architectural stuff. And I guess I'm going to... I guess I'm going to say that, you know, was so good because I wasn't kind of aware of where it was going on. But for me personally, the sort of sequence that had a wow factor for me was the shot in Paris with the hot air balloon rising.
Right.
So we're now up in, I guess, what, about five or six. He's in Paris. And the reason I single this one out over some of the others is that in the earlier shots, the set extension, etc., there's... you know, I guess, in a slightly controlled environment, but also, you know, it's a pretty big part to the plot. So it's easy to justify, you know, if you're only going to build the buildings to two stories, and clearly you're going to devote a lot of effort to set extension and stuff. Now, that wasn't simple because, as we'll come back to in a minute, they decided to shoot the whole thing like on a 14mm lens, but still, I could kind of buy it. But that sequence in Paris, to me, what I find most interesting about it, It was sort of a one-off scene. We came to it, it happened, and we left. So they had to build a huge amount of digital assets for what was essentially a spike in the story, in the sense that this wasn't going to be reusable assets. They had to add a digital crowd. They had to add a large amount of basically France. So you had like a guy standing in a field with a small number of extras, and they turned that into this massive crowd with, you know, huge amounts of stuff around them. And right. I just didn't... get pulled out of the story when it was on. And when I watched the shot, I just kind of was like, wow, man, they've just really gone to town on this, thinking that it was going to be like a huge event. And it was over, and that was it. And I was like, these guys, somebody loved this, right? Somebody put a lot of effort into... because you know what I mean? Like, John, it's like that. If you've got a single area like that, it's easy to kind of say, well, we can't really afford to devote it because it's only on screen for a short period and it never gets reused. And clearly that wasn't the case.
Yeah, and my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I swear to God, there's so much material here, I'm going to conflate something. My understanding is that they had 50 or so people in it, and I've seen photos of the background where it's just these massive, I hate to even call them green screens because they're not really that green.
They're like tops.
I know some of it is just hideously ugly, and I can't, some of the green, and I'm shocked at how well they did on this, but... My understanding is that they had problems basically doing crowd simulation with what they were given, and so they went back into the studio, built like a 3D representation of some of the actors in full period costume, did motion capture, and then just artificially added actual all of this 3D work into that scene, and also in the scene with Benjamin Franklin, I guess.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And this sort of related to that point I was hitting on earlier. This desire to shoot everything with a wide angle, sort of 14mm lens. So in that shot, storyboarded, it was a pretty standard kind of shot. You were going to just crowd replicate. So they did have a bunch of extras there in this field that they were going to move around. And you know how you do that? You move them all to the left, move them all to the right. Everyone move back a bit. Photograph it four times, comp them all together, and you're away. The trouble is, in a wide angle lens, handheld, moving around a lot, you can't just shoot a bunch of crowd and then replicate it and do a Photoshop and end up with it. So you're absolutely right, they ended up doing full motion capture in the suite to get these extras, and not only that, there's vast architectural details at the background. That I guess is the only other one I was going to say that, and you're right, because there's a heck of a lot of interesting stuff in this. The other one was when he goes to court in England, and in England at St. James, they basically shot stills only, went to green screen in Hungary and shot the foreground and then composited those together. And it's a pretty slow-moving scene because of the nature of the material at that point. It's very subdued and played out. And I was completely caught up in what was going on and didn't even notice that the whole thing was a comp, which means that the king, because I normally go for that in a second, the king in that whole St. James palace sequence was just superb. And so I probably should actually, if I was giving out my tick of the week, give it to that, because getting compositing that clean, that good in slow long shots is a pretty remarkable feat. And normally I find it doesn't stack up that well to have a completely virtual set. Now they did have a lot of previs on that, and in the story that we've got on FX Guide about this, where we actually speak to Jeff Goldman, who was one of the people that won the Emmy, he actually said that was probably the most enjoyable sequence they worked on, but it was seamless. That, didn't you think, the St. James Palace stuff?
I thought it was absolutely amazing. There's so much to talk about on this. The steps. I noticed something really interesting when Giamatti is walking up the steps is that the St. James Cathedral that he's walking up?
St. James Palace in England. Palace,
yeah. Yeah, so he's walking up these steps, and I noticed they did something really, really, really interesting, which is I noticed that the frame rate actually sped up for a second as they were zooming in on Paul Giamatti's face. There was a very quick, sort of maybe 50% or 30% faster frame rate. So you sort of zoom in with this kind of odd, quick zoom, and then it slows down and then it speeds up again. And I imagine they did that because there was some aspect of the background that just wasn't working and they were trying to flash past it. But it was done in such an amazingly good and artistic way that it was the second time I watched it before I noticed it.
I mean, I guess for me, one of the things is that the whole cinematography isn't what I expected. The use of the wide-angle lenses, the way that it works, just wasn't what I expected at all. It was actually slightly off-putting to me early on, that wide-angle, big distortion kind of thing. And there's quite a lot of dutching as well. There were shots, matte paintings, that just the horizon wasn't level. And I kept on looking at it going, well, there's no way that you're going to do a shot of, the White House being built where you don't get the camera level, other than he just wanted to have a more documentary, more we were really there capturing the moment kind of feel about it. But the 14mm right up on some of the actors' faces during some of the sort of dramatic sequences almost got to the point where you were like, this is one of those somebody's drugged and I've got the wide angle shot of people laughing at them kind of look. I was like, am I tripping? Are they what's going on here?
Right. And entire scenes where the actor would be so far in the right hand corner of the frame, and so distorted, and then the camera would be dutched, and you're just Yeah, you're like, holy crap, what am I some person sort of tilting their head in the background viewing this scene? This is,
yeah.
I feel like I'm looking at it from the cheap seats, you know, in the theater.
Which made and for some really complicated tracking. I mean, we're not just joking. Literally, the most common lens they used was a 14.5mm lens. And they use Bijou and 3D Equalizer, but they use 3D Equalizer a lot because 3D Equalizer is the big guns you pull out when you have to do lots of manual intervention to get a track to work, and full credit to the guys for pulling that off. Hey, another sequence we have to talk about because it's just too hoopy for words is this thing I mentioned earlier about shooting the ship crossing on top of a hill.
Right.
So just set that up for us, John.
Oh, yeah. It looks like the ship wasn't even on a gimbal or a wharf or anything. It was literally just a ship built as a set on a hill in, and I can't remember exactly where it was. So you'll have to remind me.
It was literally like a grassy knoll where they were shooting principal photography.
Was that in Virginia or
yep,
was that?
I think it was in Virginia.
Yeah. Because there was a tremendous number of sets built in Virginia. In fact, it's hilarious to look at the sets. Because like you said, the budget for the set design only allowed for two stories, sometimes one. And so at the top of the buildings, you have these basically pieces of wood painted green wrapped around all of the buildings. Like, oh, that's where it's going to extend. And with the ship, you have the same thing. That's just these giant, ugly, badly lit, greenish tarps just everywhere, right? Just all over the front of the ship, kind of masking out a lot of the background, except for a tremendous amount of the sky, which was still visible.
Well, I mean, I think what's extraordinary there, according to Jeff in the interview we did with him, that HBO was like, well, this isn't actually a big sequence in the script. This is, you know, just he's going over, and yes, he's going to get seasick with his son, but we hadn't really allowed much for this. So you have one day to shoot this in. Now, anyone that's shot on set on any kind of setup with lots of actors, especially an effects sequence, one day is not a lot to do. And the director managed to knock out 80 to 100 shots in that single one day, which is, as Jeff Goldman himself says, pretty friggin' amazing. And then this is where it gets really bad. Not only did they have to shoot that many sequences with, you know, effectively a large crew with a cutter trying to get across the Atlantic, but the shot started growing and growing in terms of how big a storm it was, how, you know, and you said this earlier, this reference to Master and Commander. They actually grabbed stock footage that was shot from Master and Commander and tried putting it together to make the roaring seas that are the cause of the dilemma in the film right up until they threatened to go to war. And so
huge problem with that, of course, is that the footage from Master and Commander was shot in a completely different lens. It wasn't nearly the kind of look and feel as what they had.
Yeah, they're on an 18mm lens by this point, and of course, yeah, Master and Commander doesn't have any 18mm wide angle stock footage for anyone to use. And they're shooting this for a 2K resolution, very film style pipeline. So they couldn't sort of blow stuff up and stretch it. And so they actually went to Fusion and built out multiple sections of plates into this water shot. Now, in the interview, Jeff kind of is slightly dismissive of how easy it is to put together bits of water. And I've done that, and it's not as easy as he makes it sound, because you don't have the advantage of in any way sense of tracking the boat to the water. Because if you think about it, the boat obviously is moving independent of the horizon line and the water. And so what you have to do is a bit like a shot outside of a window, the one I always talk about as our kind of, you know, barometer of how good a show is. You have to kind of guess what would the waves be doing and how would the horizon line be moving to kind of match up with what normally is going on with the gimbal. As you said, though, they didn't have a gimbal. So somebody's having to sit there and just go, well, I think if we rolled the horizon to the right and then up and down a bit here, it would look good. And, oh, I have a wave I can use over here. And this time I could put that in over there. And then this actor seems to lurch to the left. So let's pretend like the camera suddenly goes right. And so it goes. And that's hard visual effects work because you have to make it look good, but you don't have any absolutes. It doesn't do you any good to track the shot when you're trying to put stuff in there that has no, you know, relationship to the foreground or any, you know, stick a tracking marker on the green dot, what do you get? You know where the camera is, but you have no idea what the ocean's doing relative to it. And again, I thought as an isolated sequence, we didn't come back to it. I obviously put a lot of effort into what was just a one act kind of, one scene kind of session, that actually held up pretty well. You know, maybe it wasn't Master and Commander, but it was pretty bloody good.
Well, as I've said before, this this series to me was so rich and engrossing that there are many times where I didn't really even think about the visual effects. They were so seamless. I was just so engrossed in what was going on. This was exactly an example of that. There are examples too of cannons firing and splashes, in different places, splashes of water that just weren't real. That you're totally seamless.
It really is a great thing. And you know what? It is just it's a good story. It's a good.
Yeah.
And for those of you that maybe more, I don't know, looking for something that you're going to share with your partner. Certainly, my wife thought it was terrific because we shouldn't paint this as an effects-y project, because at the heart of it is probably a love story between Adams and his wife. And then, laid on that is historical stuff, and laid on top of that is really interesting visual effects, and laid on top of that is really great cinematography. So it's actually a pretty darn rich tapestry of stuff. And I'm yet to find somebody that's seen it that hasn't liked it. But I have found a lot of people that maybe, I don't know if this was the case for you, but sort of thought they should see it, never got around to it because it's like a historical drama and, hey, that's not kind of where I'm at. And if we can do anything in this podcast, we should, really underline that it's some quality filmmaking with some actual story, I don't think at any point was I sort of reaching for the remote to kind of pause it and point out huge plot hole, which is what I normally do in a situation like this.
Right.
They really did construct it sensibly. And the only point that I was about to choke on, though I was Googling at the same second, was the very end, his death, and how his death was within seconds of his arch rival. Maybe you want to, set up what happened there at the end of the film?
I'm not really sure exactly how to set that up. The idea here is that you have two people who are so bound together, one, in their belief in the idea of law and the idea of something being fair and just and all of this, and one who's, essentially in a lot of ways the opposite of that. But they're so connected, in a kind of Lex Luthor Superman-like way that they somehow, when they die, they die in almost the same time.
So in real life, they were such rivals that and so this is my point earlier, that I was so convinced this was the only contrived thing that I was going to be able to rip it to shreds over. But this is actually what happened, is that Adams died and actually died second, but thought he died was going to die first, and kind of his last dying breaths was to comment on this, right? But unbeknownst to him, across town, and so it was like at that point, I was like, they had to do the big cheesy thing at the end, only to sort of Google and discover this is exactly what happened in history, that he didn't know, and that right to the end, his rivalry remained forefront in his thinking. And it's horrendous and yet terrific that that happened, I think, because in one sense, if you didn't know that that's what happened in real life, you might be dismissive of it being a quote Hollywood moment, but apparently that's exactly what happened. They died within minutes of each other, and of course back in those days, not knowing, having no forms of modern communication to know that someone was passing, you wouldn't know that somebody had passed for like a week. So I thought that there's just nothing in the plot, nothing at all, that I was sort of feeling really crappy about, other than I felt bad for his family that they didn't spend much time with him. But I couldn't do this. It's a visual effects podcast, but I couldn't do this without discussing the quality of the acting from the two leads. I really thought this was just standout performances. And I know it's not a VFX thing, but man, did they sell those shots. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, well, it's hard to say that so basically every single thing I've ever seen Paul Giamatti in, I've been blown away by his performance, up to and including the M. Night Shyamalan Ding Dong, whatever thing, Lady in the Water, which I just, is,
but Sideways,
it's just
right?
A
Sideways,
horrific film,
it's
but,
Sideways.
But Giamatti sells it. Yeah, Sideways is where I first, I think, like everyone, first thought, wow, this guy is
really good. But yet,
yeah, where are the Oscars for this guy? He's knocking it out.
But he didn't have in that Sideways performance any hint of the grandeur and reserved intellect that we get in this performance. And, you know, it's so easy sometimes, I think, to actors are really good, and then you sort of discover they're actually a bit like that in real life. And, you know, whereas he's acting. I mean, he's and also his wife, Abigail, Laura Linney, plays such a good, right, you know, sort of foil to him. And I remember somebody, actually one of the writers, talking about Roseanne and the TV series Roseanne, and he was saying, look, here's the thing. You can have a really obnoxious character that does all sorts of horrendous things, but you have to have one thing that they hold dear, that the audience holds dear, and then you'll forgive them all sins. And in the case of Roseanne, it was that she loved her kids and would do anything for her kids, right? She'd, like, kill for them. She could be completely obnoxious. As long as the writers never had a turn on her kids, the audience would hold it. And he was, you know, discussing this analytically, not as a kind of a fan thing, and the structure of the plot. And I kept on noticing in this, in terms of the writing, that no matter how much John Adams, the man as a politician, would do things that you'd cringe over, especially the whole, you know, Highness Royal stuff to do with Washington and how Washington should be regarded, and you're sort of sitting there cringing over it. It was his dedication to his wife that kind of, you know, you forgave all, and her performance in believing in him that, of course, let us, you know, root for him even when he was kind of not winning the day. I really hope that next week, when the acting Emmys are handed out, that that Paul is recognized, because I think it's just a standout performance. I think also the other thing that's interesting is, and I was discussing some of the reasons why I think this is, you know, appealing to a wider audience than maybe it otherwise should, is, again, being an outsider, it's dangerous me commenting on this, but it did seem to resonate with current US politics, the whole idea of the presidential position over whether it would be popular or not to get into a war, whether or not it was the right thing to do, and whether defending the country was correct, or whether it was, you know, making peace was correct, and whether that would be seen as being weak by allies and stuff. And so there were just a lot of layers to this production.
Well, and let's be clear, they actually delayed the release of John Adams on HBO to coincide more closely with some events that were happening in and around the election.
Now, which election was that?
I believe it was the Democratic primaries. I'm trying to remember exactly when.
Okay.
Because it was supposed to come out, and then they said, well, let's delay it so that it basically happens around a lot of the time when we're, you know, we're trying to figure out who's going to be the, you know, Democratic nominee and who's going to be. And so they waited. My understanding is that HBO waited 30 or 40 days to make sure that it coincided with some things that were happening on the political landscape in the U.S.
I mean, it is really interesting to watch that that breakdown of, you know, the sense that somebody has a commitment to something greater than themselves, and certainly the ideals. And also, I guess, from a historical perspective, it's astonishing the level of the beliefs, the level of the commitment to such lofty sentiments as was, you know, those founding documents. And then to think that the Civil War would break out just, what, 50 years after this? I mean, one of the most bloody sort of civil wars of any Western country seen in, you know, in, I don't want to say modern history, but, you know, in certainly the last few hundred years. And that it was, I mean, it really, I hope if there was going to be a sequel to this, I would hope that they wouldn't do it. Obviously, John Adams' life is done, but I mean, it would be how that then ran from this period into the Civil War and the lead up to it, because, you know, it is genuinely illuminating to do, and I would love to see the filmmakers tackling that in the same, because, you know, we've got the I don't know, you know, Gone with the Wind kind of Civil War thing, but it would be great to see the same kind of, because the grittiness we started this discussion with, the idea of, you know, them getting gritty and dirty and stuff, that was also a point that they themselves picked up when they were at the end, in the last, I think it is, episode of the series, discussing that very famous painting, which I'm afraid I don't know who did it, of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. That is very famous. Do you know the artist that depicted
us having?
Yeah, and I don't know that he necessarily was known for any other work, but it's a very famous piece that you'd know second you saw it. And it's a very lofty kind of piece where they're signing the parchment, and it's all sort of rarefied, you know, almost like God rays coming through the window, and John Adams himself is standing in front of it, and they present it to him, if you haven't seen the show. And And they said, "Well, you're pleased with this?" And, you know, you couldn't imagine him not being pleased with this sort of great heroic depiction. And he's just like, "Well, nothing happened like that. It was completely a lie. People were scurrying in the middle of the night and signing it. They were bickering and arguing with each other. They never stood in the same room together." And I just loved that they did that, that they were sort of self-referential enough to point out the way we do paint history as being a very clean and sparkly, perky, God ray kind of environment. So I'd love to see the same filmmakers tackling something else. Actually, speaking of that, this is... True Tone, which is Tom Hanks's production company that did Band of Brothers. Did you see that?
I did, yes.
Loved that. And I can't wait to see their next production, which is Pacific, which is effectively the sequel of Band of Brothers set in the Pacific Theatre. So I guess there's some hope. I mean, it's an odd to hope for a sequel for a film that clearly covers one man's life. But these dramas that are sort of... I don't know how to put it. I think it's fair to say this is something that HBO seems to do. I think only the BBC and HBO, really globally, I know of, does this kind of really great quality miniseries production. Because this must have cost a fortune.
Yeah, I've been trying to figure out. I've looked and looked and looked to try and figure out what the budget on this was, and it's just it's impossible to glean the exact budget. They're so tight-lipped about it. You get such conflicting information that you just really don't know.
Do
you have some sense of the budget?
I don't. I know that the budgets on stuff like Pacific are huge. I imagine this would have had less of a budget because Pacific was built on the, you know, huge success of Band of Brothers, and also the fact that I think Band of Brothers also was I think Spielberg was involved in that as well as Tom Hanks. But I mean, you know, even if you knew this was going to be a huge hit, which was, you know, hard to imagine that a political, you know, costume right. drama was going to be mega. I mean, you know, how big is the audience for this at the best of times? You know, you're not going to get back the kind of money that you do on a major motion picture. And I think it's to the credit of Café FX in particular that they approach this as a feature film. I mean, they're doing a 2K pipeline. They're a feature film mentality, obviously, in the way that they tackled this. And
they had so few people working on it. I mean, one of the things that I'd like to highlight just in general is, like you said, we're shooting on this strange, 14.5 mil lens. We're walking around, a lot of handheld shots, a lot of really difficult stuff to track. There's a scene in the first episode where Paul Giamatti's walking through this sort of muddy road kind of place, and there's all kinds of stuff going on in the background, and you look at that shot and you just say, wow, that's just amazing. And then you look at the original, like a photograph of the original scene, and you realize that nearly all of what you're looking at that is, behind Giamatti and that is anywhere above, you know, like a half story on the buildings, it's all been redone. It's all been replaced. It's something that just wasn't there. And you just think, my God, the camera's turned sideways. It's on this weird lens. That's insane. And there's another scene. Hundreds of these scenes, but there's another scene in the shipyard at the very beginning where I guess we meet John Hancock, and they're walking. They're essentially walking across the dock, and there's this, I don't know, like net, this rope, net. And they walk behind it, and the entire background is completely artificial through a net back behind them. I mean, you were talking about, you know, roto and all. I can't even imagine the amount of work that it took to do this. And like I say, you got a team of 50 people at Café FX doing 320 shots.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
I think the other person we should talk about is Eric Henry, who's the visual effects supervisor from HBO, because we've been discussing... Right. The visual effects basically in terms of the lead house, which is Café FX, and there's nothing wrong with that because they did a great job, and Jeff Goldman, but Jeff actually reported to Eric, and I'm not that familiar with Eric other than if you look at his IMDb credits, he has an amazingly weird mix of stuff that he's worked on.
Right, he's done things like Snakes on a Plane and Shop Girl, Gothka. He also
Did Battlefield Earth and Batman Returns and Mighty Morphin Power Rangers.
Right. Well, and Alien Resurrection, which I lovingly refer to as something that isn't the word resurrection, because I think it's the worst alien movie ever made.
Third one's worse.
My understanding, though, is that he was the visual effects supervisor only on the first episode, Join or Die. Is that inaccurate or is that accurate?
No, I think he actually was on the whole lot. I think he was on, if you look on IMDb, it mentions Join or Die because that was the episode that was submitted for the Emmy. And the way IMDb works is you kind of get linked through stuff. So sometimes, sometimes you work on something, you don't get your name in there at all because it's weird, but sometimes you get linked through stuff. They had to pick.
Well, yeah, we know that firsthand, right? We've worked on stuff and it just has never surfaced on IMDb because we weren't a principal nominated for something.
But, as I understand it, he was on all seven and
excellent.
He had a very good working relationship with Cafe Effects as the other effects houses. And so I think, without knowing his work intimately, I'd have to say this is some of the finest work he's done. And I certainly hope that he gets a chance to now go on and do something something bigger. Well, I say bigger, I guess more considered, because some of the stuff that he's done has been, very good. I mean, he was working on About Schmidt, which I think was kind of good. But, I think, it's certainly the case that winning the Emmy should help. And congratulations to him for doing it, because I think, it really was probably one of the most impressive things we've seen in a while. And, this is a category that gets, as I say, a kind of interesting, because the other one that won the Emmy last night was Battlestar Galactica, who won for special effects in a series. Now, the episodic series thing is kind of different to the miniseries thing, because in an episodic series, you have time constraints. I know I've spoken to episodic series people have on Heroes or whatever, they might have 2 weeks to turn some stuff around. Whereas on a mini series, you tend to have a longer period of time and there's more of a feature film benchmark set, and yet you tend to still have television type budgets. I mean, they're obviously pretty good budgets, but they're still not a lot when you consider it stretched over, seven episodes or whatever. So I think that both episodic television and miniseries have their own unique constraints, and I completely applaud the Battlestar Galactica people because I think they did magnificent stuff, though we just don't happen to be talking about that show today. But it is a hard job to pull off the quality consistently through a whole series. Vast amounts of material, often long shots because it's not a fast-cutting thing on a miniseries like this. And yet, you're not going to have the budget that you have on a major feature effects, major feature film visual effects sequence. You just can't recoup money. You can't make a $150 million miniseries and hope to get your money back. So I don't know that probably get enough credit. I think it's great that for the Emmys for this very reason, but it is a little easy just to focus on the feature film guys, and a lot of people do exceptionally good work in episodic television and in miniseries.
Yeah, there's some really great stuff out there. I don't know if you've had an opportunity to see Fringe.
No, I haven't. I've heard it mentioned. What is that?
Fringe is just, it's a new show. I don't even remember. I don't have cable. I watch everything off iTunes or whatever, so I don't even know what channel it's on, or what station. But Fringe is just a new show with some really just staggeringly good visual effects. So it's certainly something I would check out. It is... the exact opposite of John Adams in that it is, the typical sort of fast-paced, lots of movement kind of show relative to John Adams. I mean, John Adams, the thing that excites, I'll tell you a little quick little story. The thing that excites me about John Adams, or that excites me in general about this kind of storytelling is, I'm working on a webisode or a series of, like a webisodic show, which takes place in the near future and all of this. And the concern that I had was that I wouldn't have a lot of things to reference and say, oh yeah, there are a lot of really good visual effects that have been done, but you can't see them. They're seamless. They create this world that you're not familiar with or that doesn't exist, but you can't really see the special effects. And John Adams is, I love that it was nominated for and is, winning Emmys. And I love that it does exactly that. It is a fully realized world that frankly doesn't exist right now. Because that gives me something to, refer to when I'm trying to say, oh, no, it's like this. I mean, it's hard to find those things.
Yeah. Is Fringe the new J.J. Abrams thing? Is that what
yeah,
that is?
Yeah, he's connected to
okay.
it.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, actually, I've heard it described as lost with, you know, with an actual possibility of resolution.
Well, I know from, because Lost was nominated the year I was, and we were talking to the Lost guys, and they were saying that, like, when they started Lost, they put that together so fast that no one had any idea of what was going on. It was like, we'll just start writing it and we'll solve it as we go ahead. Like, no one sat down on Lost and planned out years in advance what the plot lines were going to unroll as. They were literally sort of within months suddenly in Hawaii with a plane going, okay, what happens next?
Right.
And I should actually point out in a sort of a weird link that the Emmys themselves, or the body, has a bunch of series of DVDs discussing the craft of making television stuff. And this is like an unusually high quality, serious educational DVD set, of which I think there are only three at the moment. And what they've done, and it sort of relates, they haven't done specifically visual effects yet, but they've done one on props, for example. They've done one on cinematography, and they've done one on editing. And for editing, they did 24. For props, they did ER. And for Lost, they were doing cinematography. And they actually go out in Hawaii and they just talk to every member of the camera department. They're interviewed in a strong way with sensible discussion about what their jobs are and what the issues are in terms of nailing it. And in the case of Lost, they actually give you the script pages for the days they were shooting, the storyboards for the days they were shooting, like all of the actual call sheets for the days that you were shooting on the sort of same DVD as Data. And then you can watch the documentary, and also there are additional interviews and stuff. And of course, in my case, I then went to iTunes and bought the episode and watched as they discussed how they had solved the problems. I was very keen to see the actual episode, not being a Lost fanboy myself. And right. It's a really good thing that the Emmys take craft so seriously. I mean, we're obviously focused here on visual effects as a craft. The Emmys that we're talking about, most people think won't go to air until the 21st, because that's the acting Emmys as opposed to the craft Emmys. But I do like that the Academy gives that much sort of serious effort to the crafts behind the scenes. And, it's obviously we have a big vested interest in visual effects. We love it and, we do it. But it's nice that these sort of very detailed areas, and I'm certainly, if I was in props, I'd feel really underserviced. And standby props is normally my favorite people on set, because they're the guys that come up with, gadgets and things that I can then film to pull together shots. And actually, I couldn't imagine a better example than their one of ER in terms of having vast amounts of props for actors to work with. But the one on Lost does give an insight into visual effects, because they discuss with the cinematographer on the day how they can do the visual effects, even though the episode is focused on cinematography. And if you want to check those out, if you go over to the Emmy's main site, you can buy them. I don't think you need to be a member. I think you can just buy them, though. They're obviously cheaper if you are a member of the Academy. But, it's always argued around the time of the Oscars that they should cut down on categories. And I live in fear that they're going to, cut out some of these craft categories that maybe aren't as high profile. I don't think they'd cut out visual effects, because I think visual effects can open a film. But, it is a collaborative effort. And it's really important to give attention to the people that that make this stuff. And I know I'm going to say that because we come from a visual effects background. But, it's an important thing to do. It's important not that you do it to win the awards, but it's really important that they do it to recognize the amount of work that must go into something like this. I mean, the whole team, I think you were alluding to it earlier. This is a really small team on John Adams, wasn't it? I mean, say Cafe Effects, the team was like, I think it was like 50 guys.
Right.
It's pretty remarkably small. You consider like the number of people that you'd stack up onto a feature. It runs to the hundreds and hundreds. So anyway, our full congratulations to the winners of all of the craft categories, and especially to the two winning companies behind, or the winning teams, I guess, behind the special effects for series in Battlestar Galactica and miniseries in John Adams. In particular, to Digital Backlot and Cafe Effects for their outstanding work on Or Join or Die, the winner from last night. And John, thank you so much for taking the time to research the film so thoroughly.
My pleasure. It was absolutely wonderful.
What are you up to at the moment?
Gosh. Well, you know, I'm doing like 1,700 podcasts an hour, it seems like. no, I'm actually, I'm on This Week in Media and the VFX show quite frequently these days. And Life Zero, we're about to kick off another series of Life Zero podcasts next week, which I'm really excited about.
But this and is then, built around the fact that you've got a mini studio now, right? You're actually building out a studio model.
Yeah, absolutely. What I'm calling a micro studio, but you know, which is quickly turning into something a little outside my control, actually. I find that I have an office in San Francisco and an office in Hollywood in Los Angeles, and then I have a place in both Los Angeles and San Francisco, and then I'm finding that I'm actually building out I have a home studio here, and then I'm building out a bigger studio you know, around the financial district here in San Francisco. So I'm like, gosh, I need to consolidate some of this.
Wow, that's really impressive.
It's a little out of control.
No, I think it's really good. I think it's great. I think it's that whole micro studio philosophy is something I think is of great interest. I actually did a story on a similar thing on FX Guide a while ago, and I was intrigued by it then as well.
Yeah. Actually, you know, something interesting. We, you know, I have Case Films as a post-production company.
Yeah.
We just, you know, we're in the final stages of a couple of feature films, and we just finished doing some visual effects and some work on a Western, of all things, called The Tailor, which is not out yet.
Oh, cool.
That was kind of exciting. And then, as you know, Mike, I have that media show, and I'm launching That Tech Show later this month.
Oh, cool. I'm glad to see that evolving the way that it has been. And it's been it's good. You're up to like episode 7 or something on that media show, is that right?
Yeah, episode 7. Thank you.
And, of course, I've been busy with FX Guide, as you guys probably know. In fact, we've been particularly busy this week because the guys are in Amsterdam for IBC. So I've been publishing stories here, and they've been doing stuff in Amsterdam. Both Jeff and John are in Amsterdam at the moment. But it's been great, you know, and there's some really cool stuff coming out of IBC, and particularly for me, that's Flame stuff, and I'm a big Flame guy from way back. And John has a great interview with Philippe Sarro from Autodesk about the new version of Flame, which actually has some stuff in there that I requested, I think, about 5 years ago, but hey, better late than never. It's really good stuff. So all of that at FX Guide. And John, if you wanted to, we just want to thank our team at Pixel Core that puts the show together.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, this is a podcast that is hosted at Pixel Core, and we really appreciate you know, all the work that they put into it and hosting the show and putting it together. Particularly, the producers of the show are Kristen Martin, Lori Apthorpe, and Kevin Hansen. And you can find the VFX show in iTunes or at pixelcore.tv.
And until next time, which I'm not quite sure we're doing next time, but I must admit I really enjoyed this one. So we might do a few more television type shows. Maybe we can even maybe we should even swing our attention to Battlestar Galactica as they won the other Emmy. So let us know what you think. There's a place to post questions on the Pixel Core site. It's a pixelcore.tv/VFX show, and that's underscore between the VFX and show. Pixel Corps TV. And there's a place there. I go there and check out questions and stuff. So if you post there, that'd be great. And until next time, thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate it, guys. And we really appreciate the feedback we get. We've actually been getting quite a lot of stuff. Both John and I are on Twitter. John, your Twitter is is remarkably not your name.
Yeah, my Twitter handle is Life Zero. And zero is spelled out Z-E-R-O.
And and I'm Mike Seymour. And I'm very boring, I'm afraid, just my name. But Mike Seymour at Twitter. Yeah, so we you'll often see both John and I you know, ranting backwards and forwards on that. And I think Twitter's been quite a good place for getting feedback. And certainly I've been listening to the comments that we've been getting on the VFX show, so we appreciate them. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. See ya.